Leading Edge Medicine provides only general medical information. Since everyone's individual situation is unique, you should consult your own physician before taking any action related to your personal health. All content of this program is intended for general informational purposes only. Good morning and welcome to Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat. Leading Edge Medicine is sponsored by Longevity Medical Clinics and is devoted to helping you feel and function better tomorrow than you do today by providing the newest and most advanced medical care designed to improve both your body and your brain. Leading Edge Medicine will keep you informed regarding the very latest developments in science and medicine while highlighting some of the Northwest's most prominent physicians, all while helping you separate the science from the silly and the facts from the fiction. This is live call-in radio at its very best, giving you the opportunity to participate in the show. Now here are your hosts for Leading Edge Medicine, Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat, along with their co-host, Lynette Morgan.
Well, good morning. What a gorgeous day. Driving into work today, I saw that neon orange sun. Wow.
And it was just as orange last night as it was going down.
Must have been smoke and whatever is.
It's got to be a fire. Although I'm not seeing it on the news.
No, usually that's where I was like, what? Okay, did I miss something? Was it the orange moon and the pink moon?
Is this Oregon fires or these Washington fires? Is it coming down from Canada? Where is the smoke coming
from? Yeah, we're not hearing about it as much as we typically do.
I think everybody who looks at the sky knows.
Something,
the valley is smoky and the sun is bright orange. So
all right. Well, good morning, Dr. Jerry Mixon in the studio. Just the two of us today, Dr.
Tis indeed.
Dr. Samira Umat has a couple of Saturdays off. She's got some exciting things going on.
A lot of family activities and
weddings.
Weddings. So I know she's traveling up to Canada and then she's got to go back to India for a week or 10 days. And
wonderful.
So we'll be missing her, but my turn will come.
That's right.
I'll stick her with doing the show on her own.
That's right. Well, just the two of us today and lots of opportunities for you to call in with your questions. We've got an exciting announcement we're going to save till a little bit later on in the show about an opportunity that you'll want to be involved with, I'm sure. I know you will be. And we will be taking your phone calls. We are live in the studio today. So if you've got a question for Dr. Mixon or maybe you didn't get through last week, I know if you were trying to get through and couldn't quite make it before we were done, get your calls in at the beginning of the show and we'll get you right in the call queue. Here is that number to call to get through today with your questions, 206-421-5757. That's 206-421-5757. All right, Dr. Mixon, you actually had an email from one of our listeners that wanted to contact you, and hopefully she's listening right now because she wanted to talk to her.
Yeah, she sent it to, I guess, her longevity doctor, and then forwarded it on to me.
Perfect.
This was a lady, and I don't know if it was the earlier show or this the second one of the Saturday, but she said she'd been listening, and we had been talking about senescent cell therapies and how important it is to kill all those zombie cells, and that she had tried the dasatinib quercetin, but that she had bad side effects and couldn't tolerate the drugs. And so what could she do without these potent medications to get rid of her senescent cells?
Okay.
And specifically, she had asked whether or not spermidine might work as well as the prescription medications. And unfortunately, the answer is no, spermidine doesn't work as well. Works very differently, but it does have some benefit. So let me back up and start... I guess it was 28 years ago when I started Longevity Medical Clinic back in the 1990s. You know, in the 1990s, we weren't sure exactly what was causing this aging process. There were a lot of theories out there. Was it free radical damage? Was it just wear and tear? Was it solar radiation? Was it mitochondrial dysfunction? Was it hormone balancing? Was it what? And at the time, the most likely trigger for most of the changes of aging was our hormonal decline. And that is still, has been proven out over the last almost 30 years, that indeed that progressive decline in our hormone status from youth to age triggers an awful lot of our degenerative changes, but not all. And so then the question became, okay, we move everybody's youthful hormones back to their youthful level, they're doing better, but they're still developing degenerative joint diseases, they're still getting atherosclerotic changes in their arteries that are setting them up for heart attacks and strokes, they're still getting prostate cancers and breast cancers. So they're functioning much better in a lot of ways, but many of the diseases of aging were still occurring. And so we kept looking to say, all right, what else is going on? What else do we need to look at? And over the last nearly three decades, I've identified 12 different aspects of aging that need to be addressed if you're going to function as well as you can for as long as you can. So if my question is, if you want to be the absolute best you can be, what do we have to do to you? Well, there's no one thing. The hormone balancing is a wonderful start, and it has a big impact, but it's not sufficient by itself. We now know there are 12 different aspects we need to look at. But always we're saying, how are these things interrelated, and which ones might be triggering the others? How can we simplify? We're always looking in medicine for one key that might answer the question. And it turns out that I don't think there is one key. I think there are several things we have to look at. But one of the more important things is turning out to be the senescent cell therapies. Senescent cells, let me kind of explain a little bit about what's going on. Every cell in your body is designed to function for a specific period. It does its job, it wears out, and then it's supposed to basically die, be replaced with a fresh new cell so that the organ continues. Individual cells may die, but the organ continues, therefore you continue. Your skin is turned over faster than muscle, which is turned over faster than bone, which is turned over faster than nerve. So each tissue has its own lifespan. Lining of your gut gets turned over about every 30 hours or so. Your skin as a baby got turned over every day. By the time you're in your 70s, it's turned over about every 3 months. So it's a much slower process. The question is, what's causing the destructive changes in our arteries? What's causing the destructive changes in our bones and our brain and our muscles? The hormones have a big impact, but they don't answer all the questions. Mm. And so senescent cells seem to be one of the primary keys to what's going on. Every tissue in our body develops these zombie cells, these cells that have reached the end of their productive lifespan, but instead of being replaced with a fresh new cell, undergo a change in which they get bigger, kind of globular, and they start kicking out chemicals that inhibit further growth and development. And those chemicals preserve the life of that zombie cell, because if we tried to force it to grow, it would die and get replaced. So instead, it says, no, I'm not going to grow, and I'm not going to let you grow either. And just like the zombies in the movies that attack healthy people and turn them into zombies, these zombie cells attack healthy cells and turn them into zombies. And so senescent cells recruit other senescent cells, and they do it by converting healthy cells to senescent cells that don't do their job anymore. And this takes place in our brain. It takes place in every blood vessel in our body, in our eyes, in our kidneys, in our skin, in our hair, in our bones, our liver, our gut, everywhere, we're developing senescent cells. Now, when we were young, we did a good job of getting rid of senescent cells. our immune system recognizes that these cells are not normal and need to be abolished. And so a young, healthy person finds and kills its senescent cells on a daily basis. The average senescent cell in a 15 or 20-year-old only lives about a day to a day and a half. Senescent cells in older people, on the other hand, hang around for weeks and some of them even months because our immune systems are less and less active and we're less able to find and destroy these cells. So what causes cholesterol to start getting laid down in our arteries and forming plaques that trigger heart attacks and strokes? Well, the latest thinking is that's probably being triggered by senescent cells in the lining of the artery, senescent cells in the endothelium. The arteries themselves are getting thick and stiff and don't expand and open and close as well as they should, and that's because of senescent cells in the smooth muscle in the artery. Vision is not as good because, again, senescent cells are inhibiting growth and repair in the eyeball and in the kidneys and in the bones and the muscles and in heart and every other part of your body. So what we're finding is if we can abolish senescent cells, we can make animals live much longer, healthier, more robust lives. When we come back from this break, I'm going to pick up with the story a little bit more. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about some of the studies on the animals and what we're doing with people, both with medications and with supplements.
Very good. Thank you, Dr. Mixon. Hope that was helpful for our emailer as well. We'll take a break in just a moment, but now is the time to call in and get part of our phone tree. Here is that number. It's 206-421-5757. Our phone lines are open for you, and we would love to get you in the queue. 206-421-5757 with your calls concerning your health, your aging health, a diagnosis perhaps. Dr. Jerry Mixon in the studio live this morning. We are going to take a break right now, and we will be back with more Leading Edge Medicine and a call from Florence in just a moment. Stay right there.
Out of the tree of life, I just picked me a plum. You came along and everything started in to hum. Still, it's a real good bet, the best is yet to come.
Best the best is yet to come.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah.
What I've had so far has been pretty wonderful,
it's
so let's hope that
awesome.
It just keeps getting better and better.
It'll just get more wonderful, Dr. Mixon. You're listening to Leading Edge Medicine, so glad that you've tuned in this morning. Welcome. I hope you're enjoying your day so far. We're talking about senescent cells with Dr. Mixon and also taking your phone calls. We've got some callers on the line we'll get to in just a moment. Here's that number in case you have a question. It's 206-421-5757 with Dr. Mixon.
All right. Well, let's continue with senescent cells here for just a little bit more because we're starting to think more and more research is showing that senescent cells may be the underlying driver for an awful lot of the diseases we associate with aging. So, you know, this is important. And early I brought up the fact that the hormone balancing, but the senescent cells in our end organs that make those hormones may in fact be part of the reason that our hormone levels themselves are going down as we age. So let's get back to that little project for the moment.
Mm-hmm.
As these senescent cells accumulate in our tissues, then each tissue that the cells are in is functioning less and less well. So your brain doesn't work as well, your heart doesn't, your lungs don't, your bones don't, your skin doesn't, nothing does. And so the important question raises is, if we get rid of senescent cells, how much improvement can we get? Well, we've got some great answers with animal studies. Not as many with human studies yet, but those studies are being done even as we speak. Every other modality that we've used to improve the health span and lifespan of animals has been inferior to senescent cell therapy. You know, laboratory mice on average live about 25 months. And if you take a 20-month-old mouse, he's already elderly, and you treat his senescent cells one time with a dasatinib and quercetin combination, you extend the lifespan of those mice by 36%. Now, 36% expansion of lifespan, more than one-third. So you would be adding 25 to 30 years to the human lifespan if it worked as well for people as it did for mice. That would be pretty dramatic.
Yes.
Now, the difference, of course, with mice is when you've got a 20-month-old mouse and you treat him once. And so you give him a 36% extension. So now he's going to live 30-some months. Okay. He's only got about an extra year that he's going to live.
But to a mouse,
that's a long time.
That's a lot.
But the point is, he doesn't have a lot of time to form new senescent cells. Mm. If I treat a 50-year-old man or woman, 50-year-old human for the senescent cells, I can knock their levels down by about 70% in 3 weeks, but they still have an elderly immune system. Most of them are still overweight. Most of them are still fairly sedentary. And so they're still making senescent cells at a rapid rate, and their immune systems are still not clearing them as well. So I'm going to have to come back at some point and treat them a second time, and then a third time, and a fourth time, and a fifth time. If the goal is to keep those senescent cells down at a healthy level, they're going to require multiple episodes of treatment over the next 30, 40, 50 years.
Okay.
So that's the downside of our long lifespan is, for us, it's not one and done. For us, it has to be a process of keeping our senescent cell load down. Now, the lady who sent the email in, her problem was she doesn't tolerate the medication that does a great job of reducing senescent cells. So her question is, what else can she do? Do we just give up on her? No, we don't give up on her.
Not Dr. Mixon.
I never give up.
No, you don't.
Right. There are things that won't kill the senescent cells as efficiently as the dasatinib and quercetin, but there are things we can do that will slow the reaccumulation. And if we can boost her immune system so that she kills them more efficiently, and then if she can form them more slowly over time, we would hope for a decline in the absolute numbers. Not as fast, not as dramatic. You know, I can treat you for 3 days with dasatinib and quercetin and knock down about 30% of your senescent cells.
Oh, okay.
You know, and then the next week I treat you for 3 more days, I take down 30% of what's left. And the next week I do it 3 more days, take 30% of that. And I can go from 100% to 30% net. That's a 70% reduction in 9 days of therapy over 3 weeks. The other approach is probably going to be a whole lot slower, but it means we have to do everything we can do to boost her immune system to the most robust and healthy level that we possibly can, so she finds and kills senescent cells. We have to build as much muscle in this woman as we possibly can. And that means that when we're doing her hormone balancing, I would suggest to her physician that we carry her testosterone and her dehydroepiandrosterone, the two primary anabolic hormone loads, at the upper end of a healthy, normal woman's level. Not into the male range, but within the female, healthy, young woman range, we get her up in that upper 20% or so, so that she makes as much muscle as possible. Because it turns out that muscle kills senescent cells. The more muscle you've got and the more aggressive work that muscle is doing, muscle puts out over 600 different enzymes, peptides, proteins, hormones, and cytokines, many of which grow not new muscle, but also new brain, new bone, new skin, new gut, new heart, new lung, and boosts your immune response so you do a better job of killing senescent cells. So getting lean, getting rid of as much body fat as practical, because fat promotes the production of senescent cells. Working muscle destroys senescent cells. Okay. Not as fast as the medicines, but it'll get there.
Okay.
So that's where I want to go with her. I'd say move her anabolic hormone load to the upper range of a healthy young woman. Get her diet changed so that we get her as lean as humanly practical, and get her on a great exercise program so that she can use those anabolic hormones to kick out more muscle mass, which in turn will kick out those 600 plus myokines that will help her then to kill her senescent cell load.
Right.
I'd also put her on the supplements that slow the production of senescent cells. So I'd hit her pretty hard with resveratrol, with quercetin, with fisetin, and what else?
The other one.
Well, probably also maybe, I'm thinking maybe try her on rapamycin too.
Ah, okay.
Rapamycin and metformin if she tolerates them, because those approach it from a different direction. Spermidine was a drug she as a compound she asked about. Spermidine is not so much directly with senescent cells, but indirectly it probably helps. Spermidine enhances mitochondrial function, helps mitochondria to turn over, which provides more energy in the cell and decreases production of senescent cells. So spermidine is the other thing I would have her taking.
All right. Oh, I hope she was listening. If not, we can get in touch with her and let her know that she can hear all of this information as well as you. Every week, we put this on our website. All of our radio programs for the weekend by Tuesday are up and loaded as radio podcasts so that you can listen again to get the information and also refer your friends to listen as well. All right, Dr. Mixon, we've got some phone calls.
Okay, let's
take
them.
Okay, let's go to Florence. Florence is calling in from Linwood. Welcome to the show, Florence. Good morning.
Hello, Florence.
Hi. I listen a lot, and I have a serious and troubling issue I'm dealing with. I'm wondering if your clinic helps young people. I have a 28-year-old daughter who, after a family traumatic event, developed functional neurological disorders with non-epileptic seizures. It was precipitated by an IUD Mirena removal, which messed up her hormones. So now she has hot flashes, daily crying spells, and she basically can't eat unless I make smoothies. She vomits if she eats a full amount. So she's like an old person in the bed. I desperately want to help her. In 2016, a doctor gave her sertraline for 2 weeks, took her off it suddenly. So she has an SSRI discontinuation syndrome, which was the original neurological insult she suffered. But our medical system is sadly lacking. We've been to doctors that all say they can't help, that she needs FND-specific cognitive and PTOT. But we have to wait 3 to 6 months or possibly more. We think she also has postural orthostatic tachycardia, because when she stands up, she feels dizzy and faints. But I know that you're very brilliant, and you work with alternative meds plus regular meds. Do you have recommendations, and does your clinic help a young person with a cascade of unfortunate events such as we're suffering?
All right. Well,
wow.
This is a toughie. Tell you what, we are at the bottom of the hour, so we're going to take that little required 2-minute break or so here in just a minute. But
stay on the line.
Yeah, I've got some ideas where we might be able to shed a little light. But this sounds like a terribly, terribly complex problem that's going to require a whole team approach, not just our clinic. But let's chat about it a bit when we get back from the break.
Okay. Stay right there, Florence. And Don and Sandra, we're going to get to your calls as well. You're listening to Leading Edge Medicine, and we'll be back in just a moment. Stay right there. we're back. It's Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Jerry Mixon. Dr. UMAT has the weekend off. My name is Lynette, and here is that number to call with your questions for Dr. Mixon. It's 206-421-5757. We have Florence on the line and much concern about her 28-year-old daughter with some neurological issues. Dr. Mixon, any ideas on where to start or what they can be looking at?
Well, first, let me start with a comment she made. I wish I was as brilliant as many people seem to think I am. But, I seem to be pretty good at fooling folks about that. And this is because I read a lot. I've also got a real team that makes me look good. So, this is an incredibly complex process you're describing. It sounds like she's had, disaster after disaster. I don't know what we can do for it, quite frankly. We have, on rare occasion, taken on young relatives of our current patients, simply as a favor to the patients, and done at least an initial evaluation so that we can write up a series of recommendations to their own primary doctors that can follow them long term. But this isn't something that's really in our wheelhouse. We're very good with the normal process of aging and what's happening to us as we get older. This is a young woman who's had some major miscues in her immune response, so that she is not responding to things like she normally would. I mean, removing an IUD normally, you get a little drop in your hormones from either the copper or the progesterone for a month. One cycle might be off, and then things would straighten out. She's been on some psychotropic medications, and, the question is, what were the underlying problems that had her go on the antidepressant psychotropics, and then why did she respond so profoundly and destructively to the withdrawal from the medications? These are things that I'd say we need a good gynecologist. We need a neuropsychiatrist. You got a whole bunch of people you'd have to put together for this. Probably the best, and we don't have those teams at our clinic, obviously. We're kind of a one disease, if you consider aging a disease, program. She really would be best served at a place like the University of Washington, where you've got a great big research team all together in one place that can approach all of the different aspects of her care. So I'm afraid we would probably not provide you with the help that you want us to. And I don't want to disappoint you by saying, yeah, I think we can help, and then find out, no, this is so far out of our wheelhouse that we have no real chance of helping you. So I'd say if this was my daughter, I'd be chatting with people up at UW and asking them to put together whatever team they need to put together to make it work. The downside of that, of course, is it is going to be complex, slow, and expensive. And I sincerely hope she's got great insurance coverage, because you're probably talking about $1 million project here.
Yep. Well, wow. I don't have good things to say about sertraline. They took her from 50 milligrams to zero in one day. The doctor said there was no problem with the safety, and she's never been the same. This was 8 years ago. So I would warn people about the SSRI.
Yeah,
drugs.
And what he's talking about is normally that's what he sees. People go off it and they do fine. But for some reason, the withdrawal had profound effects on her as an individual. And I have no idea why.
We do have the MTHFR gene variant. And the ER has put her on lorazepam twice a day for the seizures, but she's been worse since she's been on this Ativan. So we're hoping to get a compounding pharmacy to wean off it safely. But it's causing hyperventilation. It's causing, I don't know.
And the anxiety drugs frequently aggravate depression.
Yes, right.
So, you know.
Because I know it has to do with the GABA production, and it stops that. So yep. That's not good.
Yep. So,
well, thank you very much.
I'm sorry I can't be of more help, Florence, but reality is I can't fix everything, and Dr. Mixon don't know everything, that's for sure. But at least I know I don't know
enjoy listening
everything.
To your program, and thank you so much for your input, and I'll follow your advice here.
All right. Thank you, dear.
Florence, we wish you the best, and your daughter, too. Wow.
Yeah. I had a daughter with bipolar disease that just drove us absolutely mad for years and years and years. So we finally found some people that straightened her out. And, you know, she's done very well for the last 20 years.
That's good.
So,
it just took a while to figure out exactly.
Well, it took a while to find the right people that had the right approach for her.
Okay.
And, you know, I was at a loss. Her mother was at a loss.
Yes. Oh.
The people we sent her to locally were all, you know, doing their best but not making progress. And we actually sent her to a team up in Idaho for 3 months. And then they got things cleaned up beautifully, and she's now been doing very, very well for the last 20 years.
That's good to hear.
So, yeah, so sometimes these complex problems that you can't get on top of at first, it's just a matter of getting them to the right person.
Okay.
It's just in this case, I fear I'm not the right person.
You're not the right one.
I wish I was.
All right. This is Leading Edge Medicine, Dr. Jerry Mixon in the studio, and we're taking your calls, 206-421-5757. We're headed to Des Moines now, talking to Don, who wants to talk about those senescent cells.
Hello,
hi there, Don.
Don. How can we help, sir?
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Good.
Doing pretty good.
Dr. Mixon, you are the man. I just want you to know that.
I prefer it when my wife says that, of course.
Yeah. But, you know. I'm glad I'm not the man.
Come on, be open-minded.
Okay, how can I help you?
Dr. Mixon, I'm probably not pronouncing it properly. Sirmiolis, is that rheumatism?
Okay, spell it for me, and let me see if I can make sense out of what you're saying, because nothing is
clear. Sirmiolis.
Sirmiolis?
With an F in the beginning or an S?
S as in Sam.
Sirolimus, R. Okay. Rapamycin. Sure, okay, same thing.
Okay, perfect. Okay, so two-part question. So I've been taking that once a week, and I'm preparing to take senescent cell treatment. How long do I need to discontinue rheumatism before I begin senescent cell treatment?
I try not to take them coincident. What I do is I do my dasatinib quercetin therapy, and I do the... If you're doing your first course, you'd be doing a 3-week, 9-day course over a 3-week period. And then you give it about 2 weeks to finish clearing out the senescent cells before you go back on the rapamycin or the sirolimus.
Okay, I haven't taken rapamycin for a week. Can I begin the...
Yes.
The
half-life of the rapamycin is very short. So
okay. If
you haven't taken it for a week, it's gone. So you can go ahead and start your senescent cell therapy, but then I'd stay off the rapamycin until 2 weeks after I finished the dasatinib.
Okay, very good. Your earlier explanation about senescent cell is outstanding. You articulated it very well. Could you briefly discuss the virtues of the rheumatism?
Of the rapamycin? Yeah.
Rapamycin's
it's a fascinating drug. I wish I knew more about it. I read everything I can about the thing. I don't think there are very many papers that have been published on it in the last several years that I haven't read, and I still am appalled at what I don't know about the damn stuff. Rapamycin is the most effective drug we have for restoring youthful or apparent youthful function in every animal it's ever been tested on. fruit flies, worms, mice, rats, dogs, orangutans, or I'm sorry, baboons, not orangutans. they all function far better on rapamycin than they did without it during the aging process. Its effect appears to be dose related. The higher the dose, the longer the animals live and the better they tend to live. So that's kind of fascinating. In modest doses, the experimental animals get about a 10 to 12% increase in lifespan. And with a high dose, they get about a 15% increase in lifespan. Now, you notice that's not nearly as good as the senescent cell therapy with its 36%. Okay. But they're doing very different things, which is why personally I do them both, because I want both sets of benefits. I'm getting a break signal, so I have to take a little break, but I'll come back and we'll pick this up in just a bit. We'll talk about mechanisms of action, things we know, things we don't know, things we wish we knew.
All right.
About rapamycin.
Very good. Stay right there, Don and Sandra, James. We're going to get to you as well. You're listening to Leading Edge Medicine. We're taking a quick break, and we'll be right back. Stay right there.
Crazy. I'm crazy for feeling so lonely. Crazy for feeling so blue.
And we're back. This is Leading Edge Medicine. My name is Lynette here, along with Dr. Jerry Mixon in the studio live today. Dr. UMAT has the weekend off. We're talking with Don from Des Moines about those senescent cells, Dr. Mixon.
Right. Anyway, rapamycin. We know it's a sirtuin 1 inhibitor in modest doses, and then we get some SIRT2 inhibition with higher doses. The dogma has always been that we want to inhibit SIRT1 but not SIRT2 because sirtuin 2 genes tend to suppress immune response. And so this drug was discovered back in the, I think, late 70s, about 79 or so initially, in a soil sample on the island of Rapa Nui, which is why it was called rapamycin, from Rapa Nui.
Rapa Nui, okay.
And it had some interesting impact. It's a widespread antibiotic. It also kills fungi and yeasts. At high doses, and so it inhibits a fair number of viruses from growing. So it kills almost everything except us eukaryotic cells, higher organisms. But it makes us live longer, which is really kind of neat. It seems to improve heart function, lung function, skin, brain. Almost every part of us tend to function better when we're using rapamycin. The problem is we don't know what the right dose is and we don't know what the right frequency of therapy is. In the animal studies, we hit higher and higher doses. We get more and more improvement in how the animals do. So that's the wonderful spot. But we've been afraid to use it in those kinds of doses for people because it tends to raise both blood sugar and cholesterol, or at least lipids. And so we try to use as much as we can without kicking our lipid levels too high and our sugar levels too high. Although there are doctors who argue that actually the rise in lipids and triglycerides and sugars in our bloodstream is actually a sign that it's working. What they're claiming is that the rapamycin is shifting your metabolism away from fat And so you're pulling the fat out of your system, or out of your fat cells, out of your adipocytes, putting it in the bloodstream, which is why we see the rise of cholesterol. And then that is burned in your liver to produce the glucose, the sugar, to keep you alive. So they're, what they're saying is really the rise in lipids and sugars in the bloodstream is a sign that it's actually pulling the fat out of your fat cells, and making you leaner and shifting you towards muscle.
Wow.
And so if that's true, then that rise is actually a good sign, but we don't really know it's true. We don't know that that is why it's going up. We just know that consistently lipids and sugars rise as the dose of rapamycin rises. There's a fascinating dog study that was published several years ago in which very, very high doses of rapamycin were used in elderly dogs. And many of these were big dogs. These were 90 to 100-pound dogs. These were not little tiny, you know, little tiny lap dogs. And what they found with the dogs in the super high doses is that within 10 weeks, they actually remodeled their hearts so that they were pumping blood more efficiently from their left ventricles.
Oh.
Now, what on earth triggered them to do echocardiograms on the hearts of dogs when they were doing the rapamycin study? I have no idea. But they did it. They actually did echocardiograms on the dogs and saw that it had a significant improvement in their heart in just 10 weeks of therapy. So I'd love to meet a cardiologist willing to repeat that study in elderly human beings.
That's what that would mean.
And see if we could dramatically improve the cardiac output, you know, the ejection fraction in humans, in our elderly hearts. That would be really neat and useful information to have, but they haven't done the study. It's used with people receiving organ transplants. It's used to help prevent the rejection of organs. Mm. And the dose for there is about 14 milligrams a week. So 2 milligrams a day, 7 days a week total of 14 milligrams per week. But those people take it for years at a time. Instead of taking it once a week, they're taking it 7 days a week.
Wow.
Month after month, year after year, at an average of 14 milligrams a week. And fascinatingly, when you have organ transplants and you have to be on the immune system suppressants so that you don't reject the organs, your risk of every cancer on earth goes up because your body's not able to find and kill cancer cells as efficiently because you've suppressed your immune system. But those patients on the rapamycin get a lower risk of cancer. It appears to prevent the cancers from occurring that would otherwise occur in these organ transplant people. So we've got a extended lifespan, shift away from fat, improve cardiac function, brain function, thicker bones, better skin, and less cancer. But what's the right dose? And should we take it every day? Should we take it once a week? Should we take it once a month? Should we take it 3 times a month? We don't know. Normally, when we take a drug or when we're researching a drug, what we do is we say, okay, this is a drug we believe is going to lower blood pressure, say. And we give it to them at a variety of doses. And we give them enough to lower the blood pressure to where we want it to be. And then we look at the side effects. And the question is, are the side effects worth the benefits? What's the risk-benefit ratio? And if the side effects that you're always going to see are worth the benefit we're getting, we put the drug on the market. Rapamycin is the only drug I know of that our goal is no side effects. We're keeping the doses low enough that we don't want to see any side effect at all because we're not treating a disease, we're treating aging. And we're not trying to fix something that's wrong, we're trying to keep things from getting wrong. And so really, we've kind of, we're approaching this drug absolutely backwards from the way we do any other drug in our armamentarium. Our goal here is not acceptable side effects, it's no side effects. And as a consequence, we're keeping our doses quite low. Now, let me jump back to that dog study a while back. When Kaeperlein did his dog study, Mark did the dog study, he pushed this pretty high because he was talking with dogs instead of people. And if you translated the dose of these 100-pound dogs to me as a 200-pound man, I'd be taking 28 milligrams a week.
Whoa.
That's a lot because we normally use about 6 milligrams in our patients. And so I said, well, you know, the dogs did well, and I'm a bit of a risk taker. And if I do something stupid and hurt me, I won't sue me. So I'm going to give it a try. So I started walking a dough. I did 6 milligrams the first week, 8 the next, 10 the next, 12 the next, 14 the next, 16 the next, 18 the next, 20 the next, 24 the next. At 24 milligrams a week, which is still less than the dogs had, my cholesterol was climbing and my sugar was climbing, and I chickened out and lowered the dose.
Okay. Oh, man. Glad you were the guinea pig for us, Dr. Mixon.
So,
all right.
The music says we're going to take a break.
Yep.
I'll get back and finish this up here after the next break.
All right. We'll be finishing that up, and then we are talking with Sandra and Joe. And James, in just a few minutes. If you have a question for the doctor, call now and get into the call queue at 206-421-5757. We'll be right back.